You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the June 2025 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part A. Here's the continuation of Peak TV by Mike Hogan. The eternal effort to discern a grand design within Twin Peaks meets its greatest obstacle in the wildly uneven second season. Careerism, clashing egos, network politics, audience pushback, and the relentless demands of weekly TV production all took their toll after a glorious 17-episode run culminating in the resolution of the Laura Palmer mystery and the death of her father, Leland. The show went off the rails for the better part of 12 episodes, only to be rescued at the last moment when Lynch himself, back in the director's chair, freestyled much of the finale. Most of it is set in the Red Room, a liminal space between our reality and the evil realm known as the Black Lodge. Here are some of the things that went wrong for that cursed stretch of episodes. ABC, citing the audience's mounting impatience, insisted on a solution to the Laura Palmer mystery now, not later. Annoyed by its lack of ownership and spooked by the sheer weirdness of the show, the network also started moving Twin Peaks around the schedule, confusing those in the audience who still cared. McLaughlin, who was dating Lara Flynn Boyle at the time and charting a career as a leading man, nixed his character's intended romance with Sherilyn Fenn's character Audrey Horn and asked for a wardrobe change so he wouldn't be typecast as a black-suited G-man. The writers, struggling to regain narrative traction amid all these unexpected swerves, spitballed some unconvincing characters and storylines, and Frost, who had always wanted to try his hand at directing, went off to shoot his feature debut in New Orleans. Here is something that did not happen during that stretch, even though Lynch seemed happy to let the fans think it did. David Lynch leaving to shoot Wild at Heart. That happened during the first season. According to Frost, Peyton, and a third writer, Robert Ingalls, Lynch was there for the whole second season. He signed off on everything. Later, Lynch disavowed everything between the solving of Laura's murder and the season two finale, and when Chris Rodley, the editor of the 1997 book Lynch on Lynch, gave him an out, he took it. Isn't it true that you were less involved in the second series because you were off making Wild at Heart? Right, that started in the second season. I was, you know, removed from it, although I loved the idea of a continuing story. Those stories have to be written, and every week you have to do another show, and pretty soon it catches up with you, and you find you don't have enough time to get down in there and do what you're supposed to do, and it becomes something you don't really want to do. This is a fascinating exchange, and not a straightforward one. As Lynch says elsewhere in the book, you only remember the things you want to remember. The truth is hard to get at. Maybe Lynch forgot which season was underway when he filmed Wild at Heart. Maybe not. But I think there's an honesty to his acknowledgement that he didn't have enough time to get down in there. He was removed from it, and it became something he really didn't want to do. He couldn't work the way he wanted to at the pace of network TV. Frost knew how to do that. Lynch did not. He let the show get away from him. It's a mistake he would not repeat. Citizens opposing the offing of Peaks. In February 1991, two-thirds of the way through Season 2, ABC said it was putting the show on indefinite hiatus, a decision that left the remaining episodes in limbo. In Brad Duke's Reflections, an Oral History of Twin Peaks, a former ABC executive named Philip Siegel says the network was very close to pulling the plug. A 29-year-old Republican political operative named Michael Caputo decided he wasn't going to let that happen. Caputo had learned the dark arts of political skullduggery from Roger Stone, for whom he once worked as a driver, and during the Reagan administration was part of Oliver North's propaganda operation in Central America. In 2020, Donald Trump would appoint him as the chief spokesperson for the Department of Health and Human Services, where he set about informing the CDC and other departments that their presentations of scientific data pertaining to COVID-19 amounted to sedition. I know, and yet Caputo was hard to put into a box. Though a proud member of the Dirty Tricks branch of the Republican Party, he also saw the Grateful Dead 427 times, and from the first time he saw Twin Peaks, he adored it. He and a roommate hosted weekly viewing parties at their house in Washington, D.C. People from all different walks of life would come to our house and watch Twin Peaks once a week. Liberals, conservatives, political types, waiters, bartenders, Caputo says. After ABC announced the indefinite hiatus, Caputo found himself bitching about the decision with a group of fellow deadheads outside a bar called 15 Minutes. I remember this guy taking a big drag off the joint and saying, "Well, you're such a freaking political guy. Why don't you stop them? If you can elect somebody president of the United States, you can stop somebody from canceling a TV show." The guy was right, Caputo decided. He and a friend named Keith Poston co-founded a pressure group called COOP, Citizens Opposing the Offing of Peaks, and ran it like a political campaign, he says. After they got a little press, Caputo received a call from Lynch. Working together, they set up a series of simultaneous events around the country. Cast members were dispatched to various cities for in-person appearances, and Lynch addressed them all via satellite. Poston served as the public face of COOP. Caputo had taken a job as director of media services for George H.W. Bush's re-election campaign and didn't want the Bush operation to know about the Twin Peaks operation and vice versa. Somehow Lynch got wind that I was working for President Bush, and he called me at home, Caputo recalls. He said, "I want you to know that I'm a Bush guy, and you don't have to hide that around my team." And I said, "Well, I'm kind of hiding it because of my team." Coop's target was Robert Iger, then the head of entertainment at ABC. The hiatus had been his call. I got word from inside the network that Iger immediately regretted the decision, so I knew that if we were at least kind, we probably wouldn't piss him off. Working in the snail mail era, Caputo and Poston collected thousands of addresses. In the final mailer we sent, we encouraged everyone to send logs to Iger's office. Eventually, the network relented and agreed to air the six remaining episodes. The fans had won. But the writing for Twin Peaks was on the wall, and it was not renewed for a third season. A few years after the show was canceled, the U.S. government sent Caputo to Russia to support Boris Yeltsin's post-Soviet government. Twin Peaks had just arrived in Russia, and Moscow was in the thrall of the show, just like America had been, says Caputo. "When I was first introduced to Boris Yeltsin, the person introducing me to him said, 'Michael Caputo, George Bush, Ronald Reagan, blah, 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 all in Russian,' and he's nodding at me. And then I heard the guy say Twin Peaks, and Boris Yeltsin's eyes lit up. I can tell you I dined out more on Twin Peaks in Russia than I ever did in America." Inside ABC, meanwhile, the sting of Twin Peaks commercial failure lingered long after the show had cemented its cultural standing. When they were pitching the network on Lost, with its supernatural puzzle box qualities, Lindelof says he and co-creator J.J. Abrams were told, "Just don't pull a Twin Peaks on us." According to Lindelof, Abrams replied, "We should be so lucky. Maybe from a network perspective it was not successful, but for us, it's on Rushmore." I was in love with the character. The community of fans still arguing online about Twin Peaks reminds Lindelof of the rabbis in the Torah arguing over the proper interpretation of Scripture. "It's the mystery that makes it endure," he says of the show. "But as I got offline and started meeting fans, I began to realize that many are drawn in not by the postmodern enigmas, but by the complex character at the center of the story." Laura Palmer was there right from the start. All of a sudden, Mark and I had this image of a body washing up on the shore of a lake, Lynch said, of one of their first writing sessions. The notion had been percolating in Frost's mind for a long time before that. When he was in eighth grade, a family friend named Susan Fresky, age 14, was beaten to death by a man in Vancouver. She was found naked, her hands bound behind her back. When her parents went to identify the body, they left their son with Frost's family for a few days. The boy knew nothing of his sister's fate, and Frost's parents asked him not to breathe a word. That left a mark, Frost says. And there was something else from his childhood that haunted him. His grandmother told him about a murder that took place near her home in upstate New York. A dead girl's body washed ashore on Big Bowman Pond, not far from a sawmill. Frost thought this might be a ghost story, but it was all too real. Hazel Drew lived a double life. Neighbors were shocked to find that she'd been having liaisons with wealthy men. That was the other part, mythologically speaking, of where Laura Palmer came from, Frost says. Laura was always going to set the plot in motion, but no one expected her character to get much screen time. Cheryl Lee was cast, in part because she lived in Seattle, close to the shooting location. "Since this girl had no lines and was just dead, we weren't going to hire someone from L.A. and put them up," said Lynch, who zeroed in on Lee based on a headshot. But no one, not Mark, me, anyone, had any idea that she could act, or that she was going to be so powerful just being dead, or how important that small decision was. One of the key clues in the pilot is a camcorder video of Laura and her friend Donna Hayward frolicking on a hill while someone, the killer, captures them on camera. Lynch was so taken by Lee's performance in that short sequence that he began finding more ways to use her, first in a dream sequence set in the Red Room, then in a new role as Laura's lookalike cousin, Maddie Ferguson. Twin Peaks, as the name suggests, is jam-packed with doppelgangers. After ABC canceled the series, Lynch, without Frost, moved quickly to shoot a movie set in the Twin Peaks universe. Defying the wishes and expectations of just about everyone except himself and his co-writer Ingalls, he decided not to carry the story forward, but instead to go back and tell the story of Laura Palmer's final days from beginning to end. Her contradictions. The good girl who delivers meals on wheels and tutors a special needs child. The bad girl who sleeps with men for money and helps her boyfriend deal cocaine would get a full airing. I was in love with the character of Laura Palmer, radiant on the surface, but dying inside, Lynch told Rodley. I wanted to see her live, move, and talk. Critics hated Fire Walk with Me. It was booed at Cannes and trashed upon its release in the summer of 1992, but the film held up over time, and Lynch never turned on it. I really like the film, he said in 1997. It's as free and as experimental as it could be within the dictates it had to follow. With its unflinching depiction of incestuous abuse, Fire Walk With Me became a touchstone for fans who identify with Laura Palmer. In her book, Laura's Ghost, Women Speak About Twin Peaks, author Courtney Stallings says it revealed both the physical and spiritual trauma of childhood sexual abuse. The realism of Laura's abuse continues to resonate with many, including survivors. We hear you've been talking to the neighbors. Mary Reber had no idea the house she had her eye on was Laura Palmer's. The seller probably didn't want to scare people off. The white two-story Dutch colonial overlooking the Puget Sound was a magnet for fans who see their own pain in the character of Laura. Inside, the house is eerily unchanged from how it looked when the pilot was shot here in 1989. You can stand at the bottom of the stairs and almost see Grace Zabriskie as Sarah Palmer fly into a panic over her daughter's disappearance. The ceiling fan, a symbol of evil stirring to life, is still there. Reber says she isn't afraid of it anymore. She's made her peace with the human fans, too. In fact, she welcomes them within reason. I'm an empath, and early on I let people take advantage of me, she says, so now I'm an empath with boundaries. In 2014, 2 months after she moved in, Reber came back from a shopping trip to find a note on the front door saying that a Hollywood production was interested in using it for a shoot. This was all so shrouded in secrecy, so I didn't know it was David Lynch, but I hoped it was. A location scout stopped by, then said the director would be paying a visit. I looked through the window when he came up the steps, and there was that infamous gray hair. Lynch came once in January, then again in the spring. Reber is not the type to get starstruck, and she thinks he liked that about her. At one point, during his second visit, he said, "Mary, are you an actor?" She said, "No." He said, "Have you ever done any acting?" She said, "No." Undeterred, he said, "Would you like to play a small part in this production?" This time, she said yes. And that's how she found herself acting in the finale of Twin Peaks, The Return. The script arrived in September, a month before the shoot. Like all the actors, she was heavily NDA'd and received only the pages of the scene she was in. In it, she answers the door of her own house as McLaughlin and Lee, playing characters who aren't exactly Cooper and Palmer, arrive in search of Laura's mother, Sarah. "It's a really, really eerie scene," says McLaughlin. "Even shooting it made the hair on the back of my neck stand up." Before shooting the scene, which sets up the jarring final moment of the entire series, Reber sat down with Lynch, McLaughlin, and Lee for a rehearsal. McLaughlin said his line, asking for Sarah Palmer, and Reber replied, "Who?" Lynch stopped her. "Mary, I want you to wait 10 seconds before answering him." She tried again, but she was still too fast. He said he would tap his leg when it was time. "When people come here, sometimes I'll look at them for 10 seconds and ask them what that does to them," she says. "It's unnerving." Reber and her then-husband signed an NDA that wouldn't expire until several years after The Return aired. At one point, her husband got a phone call from Sabrina Sutherland, Lynch's longtime producer. "David and I are not happy with you," Sutherland said. "We hear you've been talking to the neighbors." Today, released from her obligations, Reber offers tour on her website, visitpalmerhouse.com. She's happy to show people around, reminisce about the shoot, and more often than not, listen to the stories of abuse, trauma, and grief that come pouring out. Reber says she has experienced abuse herself. She also lost her son 3 years ago. She is no stranger to the complicated emotions that her visitors bring to these encounters. There's a paradox at the center of the Laura Palmer tragedy. She dies, and yet she inspires others to carry on. In the return, her character takes on mythical dimensions, becoming a Christ-like Messiah figure who sacrifices herself to destroy a larger evil. But I think the people who come to this house, who cry with Reber, take a simpler view of the character. As Laura Kelly wrote in Screen Rant, Frost and Lynch's creation has such enduring significance because it squashed the idea of the perfect victim. Lee rarely speaks to journalists, but her friend the writer, Scott Ryan, says she expects to have intense encounters with fans and takes her responsibility to them seriously. You see the woman in line coming up. Cheryl knows it's coming. You know it's coming. They're going to go over to the corner, and Cheryl just takes that all in, Ryan says. She has helped so many people. To me, that's the whole heart of Twin Peaks. What Laura Palmer represents to these women, and probably some men who have been sexually abused. Pure David. Fire Walk With Me's commercial failure put a stake in the heart of Twin Peaks, as far as I could tell, Frost later said. But then something funny happened. Instead of fading into oblivion, the show continued to fascinate old fans and meant new ones. Josh Eisenstadt is a filmmaker and longtime fan who has formed friendships with many members of the cast, based in part on his photographic memory of every detail of the show. He remembers a surge of visitors to the annual Twin Peaks Festival in Snoqualmie around 2011 when the series first came to Netflix. That's around the time when Frost reached out to Lynch with an idea for how to move the story forward. They began writing together, first in person, and then over Skype after Frost moved to Ojai. When they had the first 2 hours written, they pitched it to Showtime. The name the network gave the new series, Twin Peaks: The Return, would prove ironic. Those longing to revisit the folksy, quirky world of the original series were in for a jolt. When Showtime proposed a budget Lynch found inadequate, he quit. The network's president, David Nevins, had to step in to save the deal. Working in NDA-enforced secrecy, Lynch directed the entire 18-episode run as if it were a single-feature film. Lynch never showed me a cut, Frost told author David Bushman. David and Mark wrote the scripts, but it was really David's everything, McLaughlin says. He shot every single frame of it. If the original series exposed the moral rot lurking beneath a veneer of small-town respectability, The Return revealed a society shredded by human and inhuman forces. As the action jumps from Vegas to New York to South Dakota, we meet gangsters, hitmen, loan sharks, and crooked prison wardens. Twin Peaks itself is overrun by a mysterious drug called Sparkle coming across the border from Canada. The younger generation is not so much adrift as it is violently hurtling toward catastrophe. Is this the grim vision of a bush guy alarmed by rising crime and the influx of drugs across our borders? Or that of an FDR liberal, appalled by the systematic depredations of late-stage capitalism? Why not both? For some fans, The Return was disappointing. Tonally, the balance was much darker than the original, more Lynchian than Frostian, and it moved at a pace that tested the patience of even die-hard fans. Cooper doesn't even properly reappear until Part 16. The singer Christabel, who made music with Lynch for many years, played Tammy Preston, a young FBI agent who works closely with Gordon Cole. She bore the brunt of fan frustration with the show's direction. Tammy was polarizing, she says, and became a stand-in for characters they didn't care about because they wanted to see what was happening to all the characters they love. The response stung, but over time she came to terms with it. Ultimately, what brought me comfort was realizing, okay, I am an entrancing aspect of this offering that was pure David. It was the ride of a lifetime, and I wouldn't change anything. Would I have taken a couple of acting classes since it was my first gig? Maybe. But at the same time, David told me not to do that because he wanted me just as I was. The critical response to the return, meanwhile, was glowing. Sight and Sound magazine named it the second best film of 2017 after Get Out. Before long, most fans embraced it and duly set about trying to decode its mysteries. According to Peyton, Frost intended to end The Return with a penultimate episode in which Cooper has a climactic showdown with Bob and then goes back in time to prevent Laura Palmer's murder. That episode is sort of sweetly nostalgic in a way that actually made me tearful, Peyton says. The finale itself, which Peyton describes as the most horrifying scream into the blackest of voids, was all Lynch. Peyton likens it to the Beatles' later albums, where Paul would get a song, then John would get one. Season 3 was their White Album, he says. When I ask Frost to confirm this, he says, "Well, I would say that we both got our ending, and they actually work hand in hand. And I mean both hours are pretty damn good television." Not that Frost has seen them lately. "Honestly, I don't sit around watching my own work over and over again," he says. "I hope that's a good sign." Christabel, meanwhile, says she watched The Return with Lynch 3 times. "What I can say is that by the 3rd time we watched it together, it made perfect sense. I was like, oh, this is so straightforward. Sometimes I feel like I just had to not get out of my head, but get into my heart." Finding Love in Hell. One morning in January, Frost awoke at 2:30, unable to breathe. "I didn't have a cold. I didn't have chest congestion. There was no smoke," he remembers. The fires consuming L.A. were 2 hours away from his home in Ojai. At 3 a.m., he drove to his beach house in Ventura and took a walk by the water. "The sea air is really good for your lungs, and I started to feel better," he remembers. "I finally came in and fell asleep on the sofa at like 4:30, 5 in the morning." 3 hours later, Peyton called him with the news that Lynch had died. Later, Frost pieced together an unnerving timeline. Lynch, he heard, had awakened early that same morning. He went to meditate, and they found him a few hours later, and he was gone, says Frost. "I'm just giving you the facts. I can't extrapolate anything larger than that out of it, but we were connected in some way." If he was truly in the middle of a meditation, maybe there's some comfort in that, says McLaughlin. Maybe somehow he was able to transcend. Looking back, I see now that I was drawn back into Twin Peaks at a time when it felt like the real world was falling off its axis. Biden was clearly no match for Trump. The institutions that shaped my life, the media, Hollywood, America itself, were collapsing. I needed an escape, but not to a phony world where everything is awesome. In Twin Peaks, I found a warm bath of cyanide, a refuge where good and evil are, at best, evenly matched. But I also found a warped virtual small town where people like me, a little arty, a little alienated, were accepted without judgment. There's a cliche of bad TV called the worthless treasure twist trope. Something the audience thinks will be a valuable discovery turns out to be nothing. You'll see it referenced with the one-liner. Maybe the real treasure was the friends we made along the way. As I reported the story, I started repeating that line to myself like some goofball mantra. In March, a few days before the Oscars, I sat in a booth at Bob's Big Boy in Burbank and split a slice of cherry pie with Josh Eisenstadt and Adele Jones, who played Lieutenant Cynthia Knox in The Return. In the 80s, legend has it, Lynch wrote Blue Velvet on napkins at the now-defunct Bob's Big Boy in Beverly Hills. After he died, this location became the site of a spontaneous fan memorial. Eisenstadt, as I've mentioned, is a fan. Both he and Jones both belong to a group chat called Twin Peaks Family Forever, which blew up with messages of love and support from the likes of Amick and Sutherland as news of Lynch's death spread. On January 20th, which would have been Lynch's 79th birthday, Jones and Eisenstadt met up here with friends from the cast and crew. After raising a chocolate shake to Lynch's memory, they visited the memorial by the mascot out front. Jones added a donut to the growing collection of blue roses, Cokes, and packs of American spirits. David didn't want to work with you if you were a jackass, Scott Ryan says. It's why everyone is heartbroken that he's dead. David Lynch could see something in the people he cast, and the cast members see it in the fans as well. There's a connection, and it's not mystical, it's humanity. A few weeks into the new year, that connection felt like a lifeline. The fires here, losing David, Trump getting into office again. 2025 feels very nightmarish, says Eisenstadt. But in a very Lynchian way, there's been this closeness with the people in my life that feels comforting and safe. David always said that finding love in hell is the theme of all of his films. The Unsinkable Kathy Bates by David Canfield. She hasn't always been on the A-team going to Ibiza or whatever, and thank heavens for that. A candid interview with a legend in a league of her own. Photographs by Norman Jean Roy, styled by Deborah Afshani. Opening photo, the actor in the midst of a career renaissance was photographed at her home in Los Angeles in March. There's Bruce. Huddled inside on a rainy February afternoon, Kathy Bates points with delight at the shark from Jaws, which dangles from the ceiling, mouth agape and menacingly frozen in time. It's the only existing full-scale model from the 1975 classic, and the largest object in Los Angeles' Academy Museum of Motion Pictures. Next to it, there's a gallery with the word Zoetrope on the door, which reminds Bates of the production lot Francis Ford Coppola used to own. That's where we shot Misery, she says offhandedly. She keeps walking. We've just begun an hour-long guided tour through 130 years of filmmaking. And whether or not Bates is the kind of person to shout about it, she's been a meaningful part of that history. She won the Best Actress Oscar for Misery in 1991 when she was 42 years old and has since starred in multiple other films that won Oscars and been nominated for another three herself across three different decades. Mementos from her projects are scattered in the museum's collection, which gives us an excuse to wander around like any other movie lovers. Bates marvels at a snippet of An American in Paris. I want to watch that again when I get home. She urges strangers passing by to listen in on our guide, hang out and hear what she has to say, and she's rendered speechless by footage from a range of 1920s films that have been painstakingly restored to their original colors for the first time ever. She sits through the whole reel as if having a spiritual experience. This is the world that Bates grew up in awe of and eventually made her home. The Memphis native is the youngest of three girls and was raised by parents much older than those of her peers. Her father, an engineer, was born in 1900. Bates moved to New York at 21 during a bitterly cold winter to try to make a living as an actor and established herself as a Broadway powerhouse before moving to Hollywood. 50-some years later, she's a living legend in L.A., warmly smiling at those who recognize her in passing. We enter the museum's spacious David Geffen Theater. Bates spent 9 years on the Academy of Motion Pictures, Arts, and Sciences Board of Governors, starting in the late 90s, and still tries to watch all the Oscar nominees. She peppers our guide with questions about the theater's projection quality and what kinds of movies get shown here during the week. She listens keenly for answers. She's not interested in a one-sided conversation. As we exit the room, she pulls me aside and whispers, "I want to make sure we have time to talk." Downstairs at Fanny's, the museum's restaurant, Bates settles on her lunch order. "I want a burger," she tells me. "Oh, God, that looks so good. I haven't had a burger in so long." The server approaches, and she asks for hers medium rare with everything on it, plus grilled onions and French fries on the side, extra crispy. "And what is your name, sir?" Bates asks the server. "Joe," he replies, fully aware of who's asking. "I'm Kathy, and this is David." Joe lights up at the friendliness. He tells Bates that just a few days prior, he was so excited when she won a Critics' Choice Award that he posted a picture of her accepting the trophy on his Instagram. He sent it to his partner and everything. "We love Matlock," he says. "It's Bates' turn to light up. Isn't it fun?" Courtesy of Matlock, Bates is in the midst of a career renaissance. Just before signing on to the CBS series at the top of 2023, she felt invisible, maybe even done acting. Opportunities were dwindling. She wondered if she should sell her house and leave LA. Just before COVID hit, She'd been cast in what would have been her first Broadway show in nearly 40 years, Sarah Rule's Becky Nurse of Salem. Scott Rudin was producing the project, but it fell apart because of his reported feud with Rule's agent. I took an effing meeting with Scott for this when Joni Mitchell wanted me to come to her 75th birthday party. Bates says later, I wish I'd gone to Joni's because here I was with this guy. The play may have been her last chance to return to where she made her name as an actor, and it vanished. The reaction that I had was a physical devastation, and to this day, Scott Rudin has never gotten in touch. Rudin announced that he would step back from active participation in Broadway productions a few years later after widespread allegations of workplace bullying and mistreatment. Like many, Bates felt isolated by the pandemic. A difficult experience on a movie she won't name from a few years ago didn't help matters either. Then came the Matlock pilot, written by Jane the Virgin creator Jenny Snyder Ehrman, and very loosely based on the original legal procedural starring Andy Griffith. Bates didn't think much of it at first. The episode introduced veteran lawyer Madeline Maddie Matlock as she charmed her way into an associate position at a cutthroat firm. She got put on a case, learned the new ropes, and eventually helped her team eke out a victory. Bates had done plenty of network TV before. She knew this formula. But then, those last few pages, and that twist. The pilot ends by revealing that Maddie is actually Madeline Kingston, a wealthy retiree who's infiltrated the firm to bring it down. She believes that one of its lawyers protected a pharmaceutical company instead of getting dangerous opioids off the market. Opioids that caused her daughter's death. The series has evolved into a hell of a showcase for Bates as she weaves between the two identities. Righteous, grieving crusader and sweet maternal colleague, the actor, long known for her tremendous range, gets to run the gamut. All of her characters have that soft heart, that place you can enter, and then she can flip them, Snyder Ehrman says. Executive producer Eric Christian Olsen tells me via email, you can feel her rip the oxygen out of the room and everything goes dead still, like right before a storm, rippling with electricity. Matlock was a major hit right out of the gate and now averages 16 million viewers an episode. Naturally, it earned a swift renewal. Around the premiere, Bates told the New York Times that Matlock would be her last dance, which resulted in an outpouring of public affection. I was like, y'all, where were you when I was sitting on the couch by myself? Bates says with a booming cackle. While she has walked back the notion of retirement, she tells me, I have a feeling this is going to be the last thing I do. I hope we run a good while. I really do. If it does turn out to be her swan song, the show has given Bates one last glorious awards run. The Critics' Choice Awards are known as a pivotal stopover for movies during Oscar season. So it's odd for a Best Actress in a Drama Series win to be the highlight. But as Bates took the stage, the starry crowd, filled with her collaborators across the years, from Colin Farrell, 2001's American Outlaws, to Nicole Kidman, last year's A Family Affair, rose for a rousing standing ovation. She's one of the greats, Kidman tells me later. I love her resilience and what she represents. Her story is extraordinary. The warm industry embrace took days for Bates to process. It's the affirmation of a career that hasn't always been up here with the A-team going to Ibiza or whatever, you know, she says as our food arrives. It hasn't been a straight trajectory. She pauses and looks down. I don't know how I'm going to get my mouth around it. I tilt my head in confusion before realizing she's talking about her burger, not her award. Okay, she says, here I go. I feel our conversation is like my career, Bates says between bites after a brief silence. my niece, Linda, calls it getting lost in the right direction. By the time she made Misery, Bates had already earned a Tony nomination for her work on Broadway, but it was as the maniacally cheerful, then maniacally violent nurse, Annie Wilkes, that she became a thrillingly unconventional Hollywood lead. "I was in my prime," she says. "I was in my 40s by then, and I felt totally in command and powerful." She also navigated a prickly dynamic with her co-star, James Caan, who died in 2022. He clashed with Bates over her stringent stage-trained methods, like preferring extensive rehearsals. Jimmy, God rest him, was going through his own shit, and he'd apologized for it, and we were cool before he died, Bates says. "I was at his memorial service, and his assistant said something really lovely. Jimmy told me before he died that he wished that you guys had gotten to know each other better." Bates ruled the awards circuit for Misery, and then waited for another great role. And waited. It was like a desert, she says. There was quite a while where I didn't know what was going to happen next. One reason why was dismayingly obvious. She didn't look like other movie stars. During one of her first interviews for Misery, which is to say, one of her first interviews for any film, a journalist said to Bates, "You're not Michelle Pfeiffer." Around the same time, the late Gary Marshall declined to cast her in his film adaptation of Frankie and Johnny in the Clair de Lune, despite the fact that she'd originated the stage role to great acclaim. "He couldn't make the leap that someone would see me on screen kissing someone," Bates says. "Me actually kissing a man on screen. That would not be romantic." How did she react to hearing that? "Well, I've always had that," she says with a shrug. Years after leaving her native Tennessee, Bates learned that her father had told her, hometown acting teacher, "You know, she's not conventionally attractive." In one of her favorite post-Misery roles, she'd rather not name the movie, she filmed a meaningful, rare romantic kissing scene that was cut from the final edit. That one still stings. The year after Misery, Bates promoted the adventure epic At Play in the Fields of the Lord, in which she and Aidan Quinn played spouses. She recalls a British journalist asking Quinn, right in front of her, "You're a leading man. Is it believable that you and Kathy would be married?" Bates felt crushed. She could guess the premise of the article to come. "I went upstairs, I locked the door, and I cried like a kindergartner," she says. A producer encouraged her to toughen up, but she needed some time to herself. "I wanted to get on a plane. They said, 'Actually, Ms. Bates, there's one leaving right now.' I said, 'Great, get me on it.' I got on Virgin Air, sat down, picked up a magazine. It's about Frankie and Johnny." Bates erupts in laughter. There was glamorous Michelle Pfeiffer, cast in the part that Bates had been denied. On screen, Bates built up an unusual filmography as an adored star who rarely played the lead. Oscar nominee Alfre Woodard met her in the 80s New York theater scene, and they bonded over how to navigate their industry's narrow-mindedness. "Both of us were looked at as the friend, the neighbor next door, the crazy one, the action away from the center of the frame, which always had a wilting, denourished white girl in the middle of it, honestly," she says. Woodard observed Bates cultivating a dedicated fan base, despite regular rejection from Hollywood. Her success is not because of a production company, a studio, a director. It is those people that see her and just go, ah. They identify something in her, Woodard says. They're touched by something in her. She is loved by regular people everywhere. "I don't feel comfy," Bates says, now of working in Hollywood, even having lost 100 pounds within the last 7 or so years. "I never felt that I belonged. But that's okay. I see them sail away in their gowns." Later, she leans away with a mischievous grin. "So now it's sweet revenge. Oh, Miss Beauty Queen, you had a career up until your 40s and you can't work? Too bad." Bates grimaces at the comment. It came out harsher than intended, but the Bates emerging in this moment, an hour into lunch, is liberated. Boisterous and warm, proud and profane. I'll think, oh, you shouldn't say this. Oh, you shouldn't say that, she says. But then I say, F it, I'm 76, can I just say it? And when Bates drops the F-bomb, trust, she's letting you in. The more she sprinkles the word into our back and forth, the more liberated she appears. It's a regular presence on her sets, too. Often when she saw me approaching with direction between takes, she'd say, what? What, you effer, what? Alexander Payne, who directed Bates to an Oscar nod for 2002's About Schmidt, tells me in an email, I'd keep my comments as concise as possible and watch her processing them like a finely tuned machine. Then I'd watch and wonder as my small directions rippled through the next take. About Schmidt remains the project where Bates was most literally naked on screen. She played the eccentric and free-spirited Roberta, who at one point makes a pass at Jack Nicholson's eponymous grump in her hot tub. Bates and Payne had several long conversations about how to shoot it. He was talking about getting a Merkin. I was overweight, so I didn't want to do that, Bates says. My tits were really big, and it was a problem because my tits kept floating to the surface. That was a difficult moment. Sitting in the tub with Jack, he's talking about how he had done some Japanese painting of a gorilla that he was giving to somebody. He was talking about Churchill, all these things. And I had a cosmopolitan, or maybe two. I had to relax. But Bates committed and always collaborated with an intense, invigorating focus. I remember her calling me one evening to ask whether she could alter the preposition to on, Payne says. I glanced at the script and saw to my horror that she'd found a typo. This echoes Snyder Ehrman's experience with Bates on Matlock. She comes into the edit after I do my cut and watches and gives me ideas. If there's a false note in a script, she's going to find it. Bates found her first great post-Misery role in another Stephen King adaptation, Taylor Hackford's decade-spanning Dolores Claiborne, 1995, giving one of her deepest, most haunting performances as a woman accused of murder. She credits her success in the movie in part to the movement coach, dialect coach, and star hair and makeup team that were hired as she requested. It's like veterinary medicine. Each part is a different animal, Bates says. You've got to figure out where the tail is, where the heart is, all that stuff. In the late 90s, colleagues increasingly took note of Bates's sharp filmmaking instincts. Bates received her second Oscar nomination for 1998's Primary Colors, the Clinton campaign-inspired political drama, and she helped director Mike Nichols in choreographing a complex scene involving the results of a bombshell paternity test. In Titanic, meanwhile, Bates portrayed the unsinkable socialite Molly Brown, who at one point encourages Kate Winslet's Rose to join her elitist mother, Ruth, Frances Fisher, on a lifeboat to safety, leaving behind some less fortunate, effectively doomed, passengers. Rose is reluctant, though, and ultimately stays behind. Working out how to approach the scene, Winslet turned to Bates. Kate came over to me and she said, can you just give me an idea of this? And I said, give me a minute, Bates says. When I came back from thinking, I said, this is the first and last time she's going to see her family for who they really are. Around this time, Bates got into directing and received an Emmy nomination for helming the 1999 A&E biopic Dash and Lily. She also served as one of the primary directors on the early seasons of the sprawling family saga 6 Feet Under. Bates may have been on the precipice of a great career behind the camera, but it stalled after her diagnosis of ovarian cancer in 2003. It just changed everything. Something broke. I stopped that whole year, she says. Then I needed to make money, and I couldn't make money directing. You don't get paid the same. She was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2012, just after the cancellation of her short-lived legal drama, Harry's Law, and underwent a double mastectomy. The silver lining of that scary period for Bates, 10 pounds were gone, 5 each, you know. She now seems healthier than ever. It's been about 20 years since Bates' last credit as director, but she aims to helm an upcoming episode of Matlock's second season, and is already intricately involved in the making of the show. In my private time, I call her the Energizer Bunny. I literally have never seen anything like it, says Sam Anderson, who plays her husband on the show. He first met Bates in an acting class 40 years ago. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Make that Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available at our website as a podcast. www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico. Interval selection by Mark Hoffman.